Hello, everybody, and welcome.
Love Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Leadership Focus, an internet radio show geared to everyday leadership, both at work and throughout your life. Each week, we present you with new ideas, interesting guests, and actionable strategies to help you be an incredible leader with a more balanced life. I'm your host, Lisa Pasbjerg, Executive Coach and CEO of Focus Coaching, a leadership coaching and training firm based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And tonight, our topic is Breakthroughs in Neuroscience and Negotiation. And our guest tonight is Jonathan Jordan. Jonathan is a social neuroscientist, internationally renowned speaker, and an expert in brain-based training. He comes to us tonight with his knowledge of the latest research about how the brain works, how to maintain and improve its performance, and how all this relates to leaders and negotiation. I know we're in for a treat. Welcome, Jonathan.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa. It is a pleasure to be part of this program. Been looking forward to this.
I am too. It's great to have you here. So starting out here, I've jotted down some questions. There are so many that I have. But one is, why is there so much interest recently in the human brain? What's going on?
Mm-hmm. I think a large part of this is because of the improvements in brain imaging technology. This has been incredible improvements in our abilities to monitor the human brain in a non-invasive fashion, particularly with fMRI, which allows researchers to see how a human brain reacts in real time as the subject is exposed to different stimuli. The stimuli may be pictures, could be video, it could be sounds, and they're able to see what parts of the brain are being activated as this different stimuli is being exposed to the subjects. And it's incredible what has been learnt from these observations. In fact, the United Nations declared the 1990s the decade of the brain, because we've learned so much about the human brain in the last 20 years than in the 5 to 10,000 years before that. And again, we can study the human brain now without dissecting it or without inserting electrodes or anything like that. And that makes it so much easier to do. And I think the other reason for this, although there's a synergy going on here, is there's, an increased interest in ancient practices that come to us from Asia. As you may remember, I began my social work career many decades ago now in the Himalayan kingdom of Nepal, and that's where Buddha was born. Mm-hmm. The Buddha was born there.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the teachings of the Buddha was about what we call mindfulness, and it's really a form of mental discipline. And in the West, as we've been researching what really helps the brain function better and best, discovering it's pretty much practicing mindfulness and other types of Eastern mental disciplines that have been practiced in Asia for millennia.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're understanding in the West neurologically why these practices are so helpful. And it's also created a nice dialogue between East and West. The Dalai Lama, the spiritual head of the Tibetan people, has a personal interest in neuroscience and is even funding some of the research himself. So for those two reasons...
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, he's not a very rich man, and he doesn't have a lot of money, but he has actually contributed some funding himself.
Hmm.
And maybe more importantly, he's allowed some of his closest followers to have their brains monitored in real time by researchers, and I'm sure these Tibetan monks also personally consented. By the way, most of that research with the Dalai Lama's followers was done at the... in Wisconsin, the University of Wisconsin in Madison.
Mm.
And these monks were, as their brains were being scanned in real time, were exposed to different stimuli and they were able to observe how their brains reacted differently than the regular person, because they believe they have spent so much of their time disciplining their brains so that their brains don't allow their emotions to overwhelm them. It's not that they're disciplined to the point where they're robotic or machine-like. Mm-hmm. Quite the contrary, they tend to be very relaxed people. When you see the Dalai Lama interviewed, he usually has a bit of a joke, you know, a smile on his mm-hmm. face. He's not someone who's without emotion, but he's not a man that ever loses control of his emotion. Mm-hmm. And it's believed that a lot of these practices, like mindfulness and similar practices, have allowed these people to have a control over their reactions, particularly that what we call the fight or flight response, mm-hmm. that the average person just cannot control,
mm-hmm.
because we haven't spent the time training our brains to do that. But if we were to spend more time training our brains, we could have the same control as these monks that followed the Dalai Lama, or at least have a more control than we have currently of our emotional responses to different stimuli, particularly when we feel threatened. Because once we feel threatened, the more primitive part of the brain tends to take over, and the more rational part of the brain, primarily the prefrontal cortex, kind of gets left out of the equation. So
mm-hmm.
once we feel threatened, we're making emotional decisions without a whole lot of rationality. Not a good recipe for behavior, whether it's negotiations or any type of context. It's a very similar concept to emotional intelligence. You know, emotional intelligence was popular, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same basic concept, that if we can manage to regulate and balance the emotive with the rational, we're much more successful as leaders, influencing others. We don't want our leaders to be without emotion, but we don't want our leaders to lose control of emotion. You're an expert in leadership. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree. We don't want them to be hijacked by emotion and do something crazy that they can't back off from. Yeah.
Exactly. And we don't want to follow people who lose control of their emotions. But at the same time, we don't want to follow people who don't show any emotion. There's
mm-hmm.
there's that balance again. That, you know, as I said, emotional intelligence talks about this. But again, they've been practicing this sort of thing in Asia for millennia. And we're just becoming sort of aware of this and showing why these practices work neurologically in the last couple of decades in the West.
Isn't it funny that we've been poo-pooing so much of that for so long, and now suddenly, because we can measure it in ways that are, you know, visually very clear, it's become real, and there's some attention and appreciation.
Yes, and it actually reflects the difference between the Asian mindset and I realize Asia is a big place. You know, I've
mm-hmm.
lived there. It's a huge area, particularly talking about the Indian subcontinent. But the attitude there is that if it works, we don't need to explain why. Whereas
mm-hmm.
in the West, we're not satisfied because something works. We want to know why. If we can't prove why it works,
mm-hmm.
we tend to ignore it. In fact, I sometimes use the analogy of the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere of the brain, with the Asian mindset more akin to the right hemisphere of the brain, that is more creative, understanding symbols,
mm-hmm.
But not as involved in basic math and practicalities. So in the West, in my analogy, we're like the left hemisphere of the brain, which is much more rational, logical, and doesn't really accept any role for emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can't prove it, it doesn't exist.
Right.
If you can't measure it, it doesn't exist, sort of thing. And you know, and we need the balance. And this is why I think this is a very exciting time in neuroscience, is because you need the balance. We can't just go with, well, it seems to work, so let's do it. We do need to have some balance and say, okay, well, but why does it work? But it does reflect the two different mentalities of the two sides of the world. And again, I'm loving to see both mindsets coming together and complementing each other very nicely.
Yeah, that's a nice turn of events. Can you talk to our listeners a little bit more about the basics, about the two primitive brain circuits that affect us, so everybody's kind of on the same foundation as we go along?
Yes, there's the two basic brain circuits, as you mentioned, and there's many primitive brain circuits, but the ones in particular that I'm focusing on here,
mm-hmm.
are the threat response and the reward response. Not very complicated when you think of it, you know, threat,
mm-hmm.
reward.
Mm-hmm.
And the threat response, when we're in a threat response, the focus is to survive. And usually the focus is on surviving right in this second, not how are we going to survive in the future or next week. It's like, how am I going to survive now? And we go into this response mode of trying to survive in the moment. And we call this fight or flight.
Mm-hmm.
The more technical term would be activation of the sympathetic nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
And the main neuroendocrine change when we go into the threat response is the release of the hormone cortisone. There's other changes, but that's the main hormone that's produced, and we sometimes call that the stress hormone. Now, I want to emphasize, though, that on one hand we've got threat, and on the other hand we've got reward. It's not, most people don't live 50-50. Like 50% of the time we're in the threat mode and 50% of the time we're in reward mode. We tend, particularly in the Western world, to be way more in the threat mode than in the reward mode. I actually knew Albert Ellis, the famous psychologist. Didn't know him very well, but knew him a little bit. Very interesting man. We used to call him Big Al because he's a very tall man. It sounds like you've seen him probably. And he just passed away in the last few years. But he said to me once, he said, "Jonathan, nature is very good about helping humanity survive, but it's terrible about helping us thrive." And he's absolutely right. We are hardwired for survival.
Mm-hmm.
And we go into the threat response in less than 1/200th of a second, which is below conscious awareness. And we go into threat response when we perceive a threat. And I want to stress perceive. And when in doubt, the brain assumes a threat. So the
mm-hmm.
default mode is threat. And even
mm-hmm.
if there isn't a real threat, if there is a perception of a threat of any kind, our brain will automatically, in less than 1/200th of a second, go into a threat mode and a very defensive neurological and physiological mode. And a threat, by the way, can come to us through any of the senses. Or let me put that this way. A perceived threat can come to us through any of the senses, including even the sense of smell. The,
mm-hmm.
the olfactory sense can triggers us to go into fight or flight, and we may not even be aware of why all of a sudden we're feeling very defensive, because it could be just a smell that reminds us of something that's offensive, or that might remind us of an occasion in our childhood where something bad happened. Now, likewise, if we smell something from our past that was a pleasant experience, it will trigger the reward response. So it can be a positive or a negative. But we're more inclined to remember what causes us to go into a threat response. Someone, I was just reading, I think in the last couple of days, I can't remember exactly who the author was, but he said, when it comes to our brain, threats are like Velcro, and
yes,
they stick easy, whereas rewards are like Teflon, they don't stick.
Right.
And it's a good analogy because, it's not equal. We don't respond equally to reward as we do to threat. We are predisposed to feel threatened because up to 50,000 years ago, if we didn't have a hair trigger threat response, our ancestors would not survive. So when the saber-toothed tiger jumped out at our ancestors 50,000 years ago, if they were to pause to think rationally, like, well, how should I rationally deal with this situation, they'd be dead. So there was a reason why we had a hair trigger response for the threat response, because we wouldn't have survived without it. Unfortunately,
right,
though, back then, 50,000 years ago or even 25,000 years ago, and this is the case to this day with animals in the wild, the threat response usually doesn't last more than 30 seconds because it's resolved within 30 seconds. So imagine on the plains of Africa, the savannas of Africa, where we probably all originated, by the way. Humans probably originated on the savannas of Africa. And in modern day times, just as it was hundreds of thousands of years ago, if the lion attacks a zebra, the zebra will either run away and escape within 30 seconds, be caught and be killed within 30 seconds, or in the unusual occurrence, it may fight back the lion, you know, if it's a small lion attacking a big zebra, but it will beat off the lion within about 30 seconds, so that the zebra is not remaining in the fight or flight response for more than 30 seconds. And unfortunately, it's sometimes resolved by the zebra being killed, but it's not a long-lasting response.
Mm-hmm.
In our modern society, and remember, our brains have not changed for 25,000 years. So our brains were designed to respond to threats on the savannas of Africa, just like the modern zebra. But now we live in these large cities, for the most part, and we are perceiving threats all the time, but it's not been resolved in 30 seconds.
Right.
As it was designed to do. So our bodies are becoming, and our minds or brains are becoming overwhelmed with stress.
Yes.
Because we're not resolving it. And,
mm-hmm,
you know, granted, we shouldn't be resolving it by fighting or fleeing. You know, if our boss says something to us that we don't like, that the initial response might be, you know, to slap your boss. Not a good idea, you know.
Right.
Not a good idea to do that. But that's sort of the natural urge. But
right,
we're not designed to sort of remain in this threat response for long. But yet, when we have a boss that we perceive as being threatening to us, we take it and we allow ourselves to stew in this feelings of being threatened for hours and hours and hours,
right,
and even days. And that was never the intention of nature.
Cortisol goes on and on, yeah.
Exactly, which does damage. It does a lot of damage.
So let's talk about how this applies to negotiation. I don't want us to miss that in our short time together.
Yeah.
How can we relate some of this to negotiation and learn from it?
Okay. Our brains evolved at the same time as commerce evolved. And we are social beings. We are the most social beings of all creatures. You know, we think of dogs and dolphins and elephants as being social. They are, but humans are more social. And the term social is, the definition has been changed a little bit outside of the social sciences, and we tend to think of social meaning friendly. Well, in fact, the word social comes from the Latin word that means allies. And what it really means is that we are beings that need each other to exchange goods and services. A social being in a scientific context is a being that cannot survive by itself, whether it's a human, an elephant, a dolphin. Mm-hmm. So we need each other. We need to interchange and exchange goods and services. We need to negotiate because we cannot meet our own needs. Therefore, we need other people to help us meet our needs, and we need to help other people meet their needs. And that's the true meaning of the word social. It doesn't necessarily mean someone who's friendly, or it just means that we need each other. And historically, we trusted the people in our band, our hunter-gatherer band, and we only had exchanges with people that we trusted, because we didn't exchange with people that we didn't trust, and because it was highly dangerous, we could get killed. Mm-hmm. So the greatest obstacle to negotiations today is first establishing trust, because if we don't establish trust, we feel threatened. In fact, we can't trust unless we're in the reward mode. And if we're in the threat mode, like we talked about, we don't trust. And we can't trust, we can't really negotiate well. And the when we trust and when we're in the reward mode, that the main neuroendocrine change is the release of oxytocin into the bloodstream. And without oxytocin, without trust, we can't negotiate. And also, if we're not trusting and we're feeling threatened, we're not being rational, because we're not talking, we're not thinking of the long term, we're thinking of the short term. And so I know it sounds very basic, but the step number one in any negotiations, whether it's formal negotiations between countries, in a sales situation, or between husband and wife, there must first be trust. And there can only be trust when the threat mode, the threat response is turned off. And because we did not evolve to do exchanges or negotiate with people we don't trust. And we can try and negotiate with people we don't trust, but it's not a very good process. It's not very effective. So the first thing has to be an establishment of trust. And one way to establish trust is to show that you mean no harm, and to show good faith. And as I said earlier, the definition of social is we need to exchange goods and services so we can all survive, and therefore negotiations has to be about a two-way exchange. It's not a matter of one side trying to win over the other side. It's not a sports game where in American football, I don't know if you mentioned to the audience that I'm originally from Ireland, that's why I talk funny, but I didn't grow up with American football. But in American football, my understanding is you can't have a tie, you know, particularly at the Super Bowl. When two sides go into the Super Bowl, only one side can win. And that's probably the way it should be in a sports event. You cannot have a tie. And if there's a tie, they'll keep playing an extra time until one side wins. And in negotiations, though, true negotiations, it's not a win-lose. I know it's a little cliche to say win-win. I prefer now to say an all-win situation, because that is really one of the definitions of social, that where I get my needs met by helping you meet your needs. And it's got to be seen as, negotiations have to be seen as an exchange of goods and services, so that there's a mutual benefit to both parties. And that is what helps to build trust and lowers the threat response. So in negotiations, one of the things we have to think of is what is it that we want, but also what does the other side want? And how can I help the other side get what they want? And when you start taking that approach of how can I help the other side get what they want, well, mm-hmm. that lowers their threat response. It's like, okay, these people are trying to help me get what I want. I can trust them. And you're not just doing it. We don't just do this to have a false sense of trust. And beyond what we want and what the other side want, there's actually a deeper question is what do they need
mm-hmm.
and what do I need? Because what we think we want and what we actually need are not always the same thing. And sometimes we can get our needs met by not getting necessarily what we want. In a very crude example, I want the newest BMW car there is. Mm-hmm. That's what I want. But why do I want a car? Well, I want a car because I have a need to get from my home to my place of work. Well, I can have that need met with a Honda Civic. Now, I'd rather do it with a BMW.
Yeah.
But I can have my need met with a Honda Civic. So, when I'm looking at buying a new car, I can look at what do I want, but I can also look at what do I really need, what fulfills my needs, and that can be a way of helping people in negotiations understand that just because they want something, let's look at the underlying need and see can we meet the need in a way perhaps that's different than what they thought they wanted. And it's kind of being creative about
yeah.
it. It's looking at it from kind of a third-party perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned I come from Ireland. I actually come from the north of Ireland. And, we over the last several decades, we've had some tensions there. We've had some difficulties that have largely been resolved through peace agreements, and not by declaring. Part of the tension was some people said, we're British, we want to be British citizens, and other people said, no, this is part of Ireland, we want to be Irish citizens. And what really became a breakthrough is when it decided was, okay, those people that want to call themselves British can be British. Those people that want to call themselves Irish can be Irish. It wasn't like the British side won and everyone in Northern Ireland became British, or the Irish side won and everyone in Northern Ireland became Irish. It was like, if you want to be Irish, you can be Irish. We'll recognize that. If you want to be British, you can be British. And they went a step further and said, in fact, if you want both a British passport and an Irish passport, you can have it. So that it wasn't like one side won and one side lost. On one level, both sides won, because both sides won the right to say, I am the nationality that I want to be. So I can say,
yeah.
as I do, I'm Irish, but my neighbor can say they're British. And not one side didn't win, but at the same time, no one lost. And that was, and with that breakthrough, the amount of people being killed literally dropped tremendously. So,
excellent example. Jonathan, believe it or not, we are out of time. Can you tell us really quickly, I know you have lots more to offer our listeners, how they can get more information?
Well, the best way would be to go to my primary website, which is mindfullychange.com. That's mindfullychange.com. I'm also writing a book called Seven Practices to Greatly Improve Your Brain. And the website for the book is greatlyimproveyourbrain.com. That's greatlyimproveyourbrain.com. So those two sites, mindfullychange.com or greatlyimproveyourbrain.com, would be two places that they could go to for more information.
Excellent. I'll put those up on my website too. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us tonight on the Leadership Focus, the show which gives you new ideas, interesting guests, and actionable strategies to help you be an incredible leader with a more balanced life. We hope that you've enjoyed the show. If you have, please go to blogtalkradio.com and click on Send Reminder to send yourself an alert by phone or email for future shows. To check out our blog and for more tips and strategies you can use, go to focuscoaching.net on the web. Again, that's focusedcoaching.net on the web. Until next time, this is your host, Lisa Pasbjorg, urging you to be a better leader every day.